Your support is important to Living on Earth. Donate today by pressing the donate link on the left of this page. Every bit helps. And thanks.
It's Living on Earth. I'm Jeff Young.
And I'm Steve Kerwood. We continue now with another in our ongoing series of stories about connections between changing forests and the disruption of the Earth's climate. The burning and felling of forests is releasing perhaps one-fifth of all greenhouse gases. The United Nations is trying to protect tropical forests through RED, the UN program on reducing emissions from deforestation and forest degradation. But the carbon balance of temperate forests also affects the climate, and that's where California comes in. Living on Earth's Ingrid Lobet has our story on a new exchange created to make it worthwhile for forest operators to increase carbon storage on their land.
On the rural highways of California's Redwood Country, horse trailers share the road with organic coffee delivery vans. From inside his truck, Chris Kelly points at a small grove of tall redwoods in a state park.
This is what the whole North Coast used to look like. Big, huge trees, widely spaced, lots of understory. But this is now increasingly rare.
For mile after mile, rolling hills that were once forested or ranched have been replaced by wineries.
No, it's remarkable, and this has all happened really since the 70s when Robert Mondavi put California on the map. Even now, it seems that there's no end in developing undeveloped land into vineyards.
That's a concern for Kelly. He's the California director for the Conservation Fund, a group that looks for intact or salvageable ecosystems to buy and protect. The iconic large trees were the most valuable ones here. With most of them gone, owners of forest land are more likely to subdivide if they need money, selling off acres here and there.
And so if there's some parcels that have coastal views, they sell those off for coastal development. For some that have potential for vineyard or agricultural development, they sell those off. And the result being is that over time you see a fragmentation of the landscape to myriad individual ownerships, each with their own house, each with their own septic system, each with their own domestic animals. And all of a sudden the fabric of these watersheds breaks down.
So, about 5 years ago, Kelly's group purchased a huge piece of land cradling the Garcia River, a stream that slopes down from the Coast Range into the sea.
So we're standing up at almost the top of the ridge, looking west to the Pacific Ocean. So everything you see 360 degrees from here is part of our ownership. And the sound you hear in the background is the North Fork running pretty strong after 2 or 3 days of rain.
It's beautiful. The air is clean. We're surrounded by trees.
It's 24,000 acres. It comprises a third of the Garcia River watershed. It has spotted owls. It has coho salmon. It has steelhead trout. And it's got this rich mix of redwood and Douglas fir forest. And so when we had the opportunity to buy it, we jumped at the chance.
About the same time the Conservation Fund acquired this property, California was beginning to inventory its carbon emissions in its efforts to address climate change. The writing was on the wall. Emitting carbon would be costly. Growing trees that absorb carbon could be good business. Forest groups and forest owners pushed the legislature to create rules to legitimize this emerging market. Gary Giroux is president of the nonprofit California Climate Action Reserve.
The most perhaps prominent was Pacific Forest Trust in San Francisco. The Nature Conservancy was also very active in that debate. The forest industry as well.
California officials designated the reserve as the arbiter of forest carbon in the state. So they convened all the interested parties to figure out what was going to qualify for forest credits. It wasn't easy, but they quickly agreed only land that was originally forested could qualify, and only native trees would count. And they turned to an expert who had spent years in the woods and then years on computer models for some of the technical work.
My name is John Nickerson, and I am a forester. My business is called Dogwood Springs Forestry.
In his home office, finished in pine that he milled himself, John Nickerson says that people in the timber business already use computer programs to do land inventories. They count the species, age, girth, and height of trees. But now he and others have adapted those databases and growth models to project carbon in the forest as well.
And so for each 5-year period, we have an estimate of the volume of trees, the species that will be there, the size of those trees, and their density. And from that, we're able to compute carbon values. So we do this, the modeling approach, we do it for both baseline, and then we do it for our anticipated project activities. And the difference between the two is a reduction and can be traded as an offset.
The models Nickerson and the Climate Action Reserve use now can estimate amounts of carbon stored in a forest in five-year increments, comparing different land use scenarios. Perhaps the stickiest question for the reserve was how long a landowner must commit to keeping the trees standing, storing the carbon. At first, the answer was forever. Again, Gary Giroux.
In our first protocol, we guaranteed that permanence through conservation easements. So you were required to have a permanent conservation easement on your land to ensure that the project was permanent.
But that requirement caused the commercial timber industry to drop out of negotiations.
A lot of private landowners told us, and public landowners, frankly, told us that that was not a mechanism that they were willing to put on their land forever.
Recently, a new version of the California Forestry Carbon Rules was released, and the idea of permanence has now been eased.
We look at the half-life of carbon in the atmosphere is about 100 years. And so we say that you need to maintain trees that are sequestering carbon for 100 years.
Giroux says many companies still find this too strict, but this time they have signed on.
I know I met with the Mendocino Redwood Company recently, and they told me they've been a company for 10 years. It's very hard for them to imagine signing a 100-year contract.
And any landowner who then wants to sell their land has to find a buyer willing to abide by that 100-year contract, or else pay back all the credits. Finally, the reserve also had to figure out what to do in the case of fire. Fire can be beneficial or catastrophic, but when there's a contract to preserve a forest for a century, fire becomes a legal risk.
All projects contribute into an insurance pool, and so if there is a fire on any given project, we would take credits out of this insurance pool to ensure the ongoing permanence of those reductions.
Once an owner has counted the trees on the ground and the computer models have output their projections, the reserve sends an independent company out to verify data by taking tree measurements. That company also checks assumptions in the growth models. If everything checks out, the Climate Action Reserve then issues the landowner one certificate for every ton of carbon he or she has sequestered.
For instance, we'll have a forest project that could be issued 100,000 tons of credits, essentially 100,000 tons of CO2 equivalent emissions that have been sequestered. We issue serial numbers for each and every ton. So it's akin to minting a new commodity. This commodity is an emission reduction that has a unique serial number, and that those tons are then placed in the account of the forest owner. And they are fungible like any other commodity that they're free to sell or to retire on behalf of the environment or to hold on to in hopes of selling them in the future at a higher cost.
The very first credits verified by the Climate Action Reserve were issued last December. And the Conservation Fund's project on the Garcia River was one of the recipients, which, says Chris Kelly, meant acting as sort of a guinea pig.
I liken our work to get this forest verified as like driving a train on a track that's still being built. And every once in a while you get to a point where they're still laying the track and you're not sure which way to go.
But finally, the verification was over and the day came.
And so what we got was an email saying we've just posted to your reserve account 78,000 tons of the Garcia River Forest for 2007.
That meant the environmental group now had an account holding 78,000 climate reserve tons, also known as carrots, worth about $8 apiece. Back in the Garcia River Forest, Mike Stevens, a wildlife biologist, is looking for a pair of spotted owls he's been watching. He's concerned that some unusual weather may have disrupted their nesting.
So we're actually now at the base of the nest tree. There's this clump of small diameter redwoods.
As the trees in this forest mature, the hope is there will be more habitat for the endangered owls.
So since we're kind of in their living room of their house, so to speak, the way that I'm going to try to contact them is by doing a gentle contact call, because out of respect, you know, the birds, if they are here, will be sleeping.
Stevens has brought mice as bait and makes the sounds of prey. He waits, but no response, so he reluctantly makes a call like another owl in the territory. And swiftly, a large shadow passes over us, and we can hear them, the pair of owls, talking to each other. It's a little surprising the owls chose to nest in this young tree, but the Garcia River Forest doesn't have much in the way of old growth to offer. Chris Kelly of the Conservation Fund explains that because of successive logging, this forest is what you might call a fixer-upper.
What we have is a thicket of young trees, all struggling and competing for air and light. So whereas in a mature forest you might have 30 trees per acre, we have 300 trees per acre. And so as a consequence, they're all struggling to grow, and none of them are growing very effectively. It's like an overplanted garden.
To move the forest mix toward more mature trees spaced more widely, the group has been cutting smaller trees and selling them for timber. They also need that timber money to pay for repairs after 60 years of commercial logging.
On this 25,000-acre forest, we have 220 miles of dirt road, innumerable culverts and stream crossings, 13 bridges, and the roads need to be maintained every year to keep sediments from coming into the river. The bridges are now, at the end of their useful life, will need to be replaced. And so a fixed, irreducible cost of management. And so we thought, why not have the forest help us help itself recover?
To cut their timber, they use a labor-intensive individual tree-cutting process called cable yarding.
One end of the clothesline that has a motorized pulley, and then the other end of the clothesline is down in the valley or across the valley, and then you string a cable from the clothesline to the ground, and then you can lift individual trees up in the air and then retrieve them with the clothesline.
This selective logging is not only making money and helping the forest to mature more rapidly, the carbon audit process for the Garcia River Forest shows it's also increasing the rate of carbon storage.
Ironically, by us going in and selecting out some of the slower-growing, weaker trees and creating space for the more vigorous trees to grow, we're increasing the rate of carbon sequestration in the forest. So we have modeled the carbon accumulation in the forest over a 20-year period, if we were to just leave it alone, and we've modeled the carbon accumulation in the forest if we would do this single tree selection. And we found that we get 20% or more carbon sequestered at the end of a 20-year period than had we done nothing.
And just practically speaking, the way this happens is you remove a tree that's crowded, the sun shines down and allows more of what trees need to grow to the remaining tree, and its growth actually outperforms or outweighs what those two trees would have had if you hadn't cut the one?
Exactly. One, because now there's one tree growing with the nutrients in the space that two trees had to share, and also because the tree we took was the less vigorous, less productive tree.
The Conservation Fund isn't the first to discover that taking the small trees and letting the others get large can be a sustainable logging practice. The Menominee Indians in Wisconsin and many private landowners have been doing this for decades. But the land group is among the first to reap a major cash windfall for the accumulating carbon. Kelly says the money is letting them do stream repair more quickly.
I would say that on the Garcia River Forest, our net annual income has doubled as a consequence of our ability to sell carbon offsets. And if we were not enjoying the carbon revenue, then we would not be able to put people to work this summer doing some of this restoration work, improving the roads, fixing the bridges.
Carbon income is going to be fixing the forest this summer.
Carbon income is going to be fixing the forest this summer. And the next, and the next, and the next is my expectation.
Kelly points out a paradox that is felt everywhere in the world where people are talking about forest carbon. The forests that are most depleted, most mistreated, sometimes have the most potential for absorbing carbon out of the atmosphere quickly.
All the carbon was wrung out of the forest and released to the atmosphere, or in some case into wood products. But now these young forests are like the dry sponge ready to soak up carbon for the next 100 years. So the forests are here to serve us in a very different way than they served us in the last century.
He marvels that in the redwoods, at least, the main income from carbon increase should come over the next 30 to 50 years as the trees are getting big quickly. Just as that income is set to taper off, you could begin to selectively take large trees out of the forest again and make real money from the timber.
And carbon offset revenue will get us there. It's about the only thing that will. And so it's this remarkable convergence and sort of this sort of sad irony in a way that, you know, we whack the forest to within an inch of their proverbial lives, but now they stand ready to help us not only to recover, but to help us solve or provide part of the solution to climate change.
Forest landowners aren't the only ones taking notice of this new source of income. No sooner had those carbon credits been deposited into the account of the Conservation Fund than the phone began ringing. Wall Street investors wanted to buy them. They're betting the price will go up once the United States passes a cap on carbon emissions. Pacific Gas and Electric wants carbon credits to offer to its customers who wish to offset their personal energy emissions. Back at the California Climate Reserve, Gary Giroux says these credits have already given birth to a new industry, businesses known as forest project developers.
And what we're seeing now is that there are a number of companies out there that are specializing in investing in forest projects to obtain the carbon credits for them at a very economic return. So they invest perhaps $1 million into a project, get the carbon credits at something close to, I don't know, $4 or $5 a ton it costs them to generate those credits, knowing that they can sell those credits at a much higher return later.
The Reserve has just finished writing rules to certify credits in forests outside of California. They've been asked to verify projects in Georgia, Oregon, and Pennsylvania. Ultimately, many people believe the world needs to change its fuel and energy sources to address greenhouse gas emissions. Giroux and forest carbon experts say the role for trees is to tide us over until that day.
And while we're waiting for renewable energy to really take hold and become the dominant energy source, forest management can start today because it doesn't require any new technology. It doesn't require anything other than a commitment to manage forests differently. And if you can manage forests better to increase sequestration in a way that's credible and permanent, you should get some credit for that. And that can help bridge the gap to the new energy economy.
In other words, the tree rush is on. For Living on Earth, I'm Ingrid Lobet in Mendocino County, California.
For more information about forests and climate change, check out our website, loe.org.
Just ahead, the little sub that could. Stay with us on Living on Earth.
Support for the Environmental Health Desk at Living on Earth comes from the Cedar Tree Foundation. Support also comes from the Richard and Rhoda Goldman Fund for coverage of population and the environment, and from Gilman Ordway for coverage of conservation and environmental change. This is Living on Earth on PRI, Public Radio International.